Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the addition of 450 more trainers and advisors to be deployed in Iraq to augment the 3,550, mostly contractors, already there that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said would be establishing small bases or lily pads to fight the self-declared Islamic State, which so far the Iraqi government, Iran, and US air power has not been able to degrade or destroy. Veteran CIA officer Robert Baer, who ran operations in northern Iraq between the first and second Iraq wars, joins us to discuss why the US sticks to the fiction that Iraq is still a country. And as Saudi Arabia and Turkey pour sophisticated weapons into the hands of jihadis in Syria, while Iran takes over the Assad regime's losing war with Iranian Revolutionary Guards and Hezbollah, now holding the front lines against al-Nusra and the Islamic State, we examine a region in flames as the Iran-Saudi Arabian proxy war in Iraq, Syria, and now Yemen escalates. Then we will speak with Alfred McCoy, the chair of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Policing Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. We will discuss his article at Tom Dispatch, Washington's Great Game and Why It's Failing, and analyze the change in global hegemony underway as China makes massive investments in infrastructure and education, while the political class in the United States, dominated by anti-government ideologues and funded by myopic billionaires, ignores and starves its human capital and infrastructure while hollowing out the state, devaluing education, and impoverishing the majority of its people. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And you ran CIA operations between the first Gulf War and the second war against Saddam Hussein. And now we sort of have our toe in the water in terms of a third Iraq war. General Dempsey is now talking about setting up what he calls lily pads, which are small American bases, I think mostly in the north, probably in the Kurdish areas. And Obama has decided to send an additional 450 trainers to augment the already 3,550 personnel that are in Iraq, most of whom I believe are contractors. So is there a drumbeat here to get back into Iraq? Do you think Obama can resist it? He seems to be the president who was elected to get us out of this war.
Well, I think, Ian, these are just very small band-aids on a gaping wound. And he has to go through the motions of doing something, anything. And this whole ruse of training the Iraqi army is just that, a ruse. There is no Iraqi army. There are no recruits. You know, there's the Shia militias, and then there's the Islamic State. So these guys may go out there, and it may look good, you know, some Kodak moments. But the fact is they have nobody to train, because any Sunni in his right mind is not going to go be trained by Americans or pass through Baghdad. The fact is we have lost Iraq Sunnis. Sahwa, the awakening, we promised them some sort of independence, if you like, and we didn't give it to them. We just simply abandoned them. We pulled the troops out. There was no political structure in place. Maliki went after the Sunnis, as you know, 2 years ago in a major way and threatened them. And right now they're looking at the Islamic State or ISIS as, you know, sort of the schoolyard bully who they prefer to a Shia state, which is would definitely just crush them politically and in all sorts of ways.
So while we're making these cosmetic and somewhat tiny little moves, the Islamic State, and you're saying there aren't any Shiite fighters available in any case, or Iraqi soldiers in any case that the government could recruit. Meanwhile, it appears that the Islamic State has no problem recruiting people.
Well, of course. I mean, they really do look at this as an existential threat. I mean, we keep telling the Sunnis, and I know this for a fact, that if you want to deal with us and get arms, you have to go to Baghdad, check in with the Prime Minister Abadi. He has to bless it. And then we might give you arms and might give you training. But the moment a Sunni leader, a tribal member, a former Ba'athi officer shows up in Baghdad, he's tainted. He's lost all credibility. And he'll go back to Anbar province, which is controlled by the Islamic State, and have his head cut off. I mean, it's not a good deal for them in any sense of the way. In this fiction of the Iraqi state, if we keep propping this fiction up like this, you know, this conflict is just going to go on forever. We just have to face the fact that Iraq no longer exists. And you have to put it in terms of Yemen. It no longer exists as a unified state, nor does Syria, nor for that matter does Lebanon. I mean, the map is all being rewritten, and if we think we're going to make any difference with 400 extra contractors, it's a fantasy.
So it's pretty clear when I watch Obama's officials, Brett McGurk, and people that are the point man on the new Iraq war, if you will, that they are talking fiction, and they're basically selling a product that nobody wants to buy. But I take it that the reason that they're doing what they're doing is that they're perpetuating the delusion that Iraq is still a state, because the U.S. doesn't want it to fall apart. Because I think, aren't they afraid that if it breaks apart, you'll have Shiistan controlled by the Iranians, where most of the oil is. You'll have Kurdistan, a very vulnerable state, landlocked. And then you'll have, in the Sunni area, you have Jihadistan. And that the real issue is whether the Iranians, if they ended up controlling Shiistan, would they put pressure on the Kurds? Or can you bolster the Kurds to the point where they can defend themselves?
Well, as I understand, the Iranian plan is they don't mind if Iraq breaks up. I've heard this from several people in Tehran, that in fact it would be useful for them because they could control the Shia, which they don't completely control now. It's by no means are they Iran's proxy. But if they were hived off from the state of Iraq, they'd have a better chance of doing that. And that's a nice chunk of territory when you consider the oil and the export routes and banking and the rest of it. They can bypass any sanctions that we could bring simply going through Iraq. So that's ultimately their goal, is the breakup of Iraq. And if you just fence the Sunnis off, that's they don't care. And as far as the Kurds go, that's really a Turkish problem. All they do, they have their own Kurdish problem. But they can probably cauterize that. They think they can. So, I mean, we are really going against the winds of history, but as usual, it's for domestic political considerations. Obama doesn't want the Democrats going into the election next year having lost Iraq, having broken up. And he doesn't want it to happen on his watch. It's just postpone the day of reckoning, just as we're doing in Yemen, or Libya, which is, you know, we've simply handed that over to the UN. The UN has utterly failed there. Everything's failed in Syria and continues to fail. And they're just hoping this prairie fire of Islamic fundamentalism doesn't pick up speed. I think it will, but, you know, maybe they think they can control it. It's controllable. They can't control it. Frankly, there's nothing the United States can do about the mess in the Middle East. We opened Pandora's box in 2003 when we invaded, removed the government, disbanded the army, the party, the Ba'ath Party. We did this ourselves. But for most Americans, that's ancient history and they've forgotten. What they're looking at is today. How bad is it? And the Democrats, even though they're not responsible for this, don't want to be held accountable.
So if then this is just a way to paper over the reality by pretending that we're degrading and destroying the Islamic State, and it's really a policy of containment and damage control until the 2016 elections, that, of course, is not going to stop the Islamic State. And already they've made al-Qaeda irrelevant. The Guardian is running a story where they interviewed two of top al-Qaeda clerics, Abu Qatada, the Jordanian preacher, and Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, both of whom made it really clear that Al-Qaeda is finished. It's a fiction. Go ahead.
Ian, Al-Qaeda doesn't exist. I mean, it hasn't existed for years. It's just on paper. And a few diehards up in the mountains of Pakistan in Yemen who are barely hanging on, surviving. But we continue to use drones against these few people, a handful of people, which is insane. I mean, if you look at the Islamic State, that's its replacement. We got something much worse with the drones. But everybody's invested in drones. It's a clean way to kill people. You know, we don't lose American soldiers. And there's a complicity of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan in all of this. And we don't, you know, it's easy. It looks good unless you look at the facts on the ground, and that is the Islamic State is spreading. And even in Syria, it's just a catastrophe because you have Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a wing of al-Qaeda. It's called that, but it's really just another form of the Islamic State, is being armed by Saudi Arabia and Turkey with TOW missiles. I mean, this is a free-for-all in the Middle East, and we're very much a minor player in this. And I think the White House knows this, and everybody's saying, well, how do we make this look good? And that's why we're sending a few troops, a few contractors, who are going to be locked up in a base, can't get out, they have nobody to train. The weapons, as usual, are going to end up with the Shia militias. The Shia militias are going to, you know, commit atrocities against the Sunnis. And so goes this loop of misery in Iraq and Syria. But as usual, Washington is devoted to propaganda rather than fixing things.
But they also seem to be devoted to yesterday's problem, aren't they, in terms of al-Qaeda? How much of the intelligence resources are still focused on this largely vanished ghost?
Everybody's invested in Washington going after al-Qaeda. Special forces are, the CIA is, academics, pundits, books. The rest of it are just going on about al-Qaeda. It just doesn't exist anymore. You have something, you have the whole notion of a caliphate and owning territory is obviously much more effective. And if you're a potential recruit in this country or anywhere in the world, you know, where would you join? If you were a believer, you'd join the Islamic State, not al-Qaeda, which has turned out to just ended up killing hundreds of thousands of Muslims, causing this. Their death for nothing. And bin Laden, we go on about the bin Laden raid, how important he was, and this is a turning point in the war in terror. It wasn't a turning point at all. The man, as far as I can see, when he was killed, was irrelevant.
But given that the Turks and the Saudis sending in TOW missiles, which are very lethal weapons, and presumably there's possibility that we could be sending in ground-to-air missiles as well, which are even more lethal, given that the real advantage Assad has is he still has an air force and he's using these barrel bombs. What do you think is the position of the Saudis? Because they have this ambivalence between the royal family who have all the money and run the place, but then they have the Wahhabis who they use as the sort of attack dogs, the religious police that keeps everybody in line and keeps them obsessed with religious strictures so they can't possibly rise up against the family and say, wait a minute, you guys are stealing all the money. So given that there's that schizophrenia in the Saudi governance system, they seem to be, you know, if the new caliphate has to be a challenge to their authority and legitimacy as the custodians of the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina, does that move Saudi Arabia into a more radical position, or are they seriously worried about the Islamic State and are prepared to take it on?
I think they're joined at the hip, at least ideologically, with the Islamic State. Their main goal is to take Damascus back from Iran. I talked to somebody last night who operates in Damascus, and he said it's Bashar al-Assad is in control. The Iranians are. Of Damascus. We've got something like 60,000 Hezbollah and Iranian troops there. They're doing a lot of the fighting. And what Saudi Arabia would like to do first is take back Damascus. They'd like to take back Beirut as well, which is more or less controlled by Hezbollah. And, of course, they'd like to take back Sana'a, and that's what the air campaign is about. So it's really a conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and that's the major dividing line and the front line in this battle. So if the Islamic State contributes to retaking Damascus, they'll deal with it when they do. But, you know, my contention is, and I was talking to a Saudi last night, and he just denied this flat out, is that Saudi Arabia is spinning out of control. You have a 29-year-old kid with no experience is running the kingdom. He's got the oil, he's got the economic decision-making, and he's got the Ministry of Defense, and he's soon going to get the National Guard, which is unprecedented in Saudi history. It's the royal family is run by consensus. It's never been put in the hands of a young man, ever, the kingdom. And the Sudaris, this particular branch of the family, which I think are dangerous, are taking everything. Everybody in the family who's not a Sudari is getting thrown out. I don't see how in the long run this can work well for Saudi Arabia. And the son is presumably this young man, the defense minister, is a dyed-in-the-wool Wahhabi with no education outside of Saudi Arabia. And if he's looking at the world through this war with Iran, they're going to pursue this where they can. And even if it means funding proxies that they don't particularly like, they would rather be on the side of the Sunni crazies than they would anyway letting Iran have the gains it has.
But isn't there also the possibility of a wild card here with Israel, in as much as a lot of Israeli defense officials and Dori Gold, the new head of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, they've been talking about the inevitability of having to go back to war again with Hezbollah to finish off the job that they started last time. And with Hezbollah overextended, and as you pointed out, Iran essentially is running Damascus and the rump of what's left of Assad and his military, and apparently they can't recruit any Alawites anymore. They're all getting the hell out of the country. So Iran is, for all intents and purposes, the Assad regime. That's got to trouble the Israelis. But furthermore, doesn't this, in an ironic way, put them in an alliance or a de facto alliance with Saudi Arabia? Because the rumors, I don't know whether you read the piece by Paul Pillar recently suggesting that there's likely to be a war in the summer where Israel will strike Hezbollah now that they're overextended and vulnerable, and they'll ride out the retaliation.
You know, they thought the Palestinians were vulnerable in 82. This is the law of unintended consequences. They could easily march into southern Lebanon. People in southern Lebanon tell me the Hezbollah positions are all abandoned. Their troops are in Syria, most of them. And they could probably make it to Beirut. But Lebanon is a ready-made quagmire. If the Israelis really want into it, they can go back to Beirut.
Well, they did that in 82, and look where it got them. I mean, they surely...
Yeah, it was a catastrophe. In the next 18 years, they just lost thousands of troops. They got... The first time they withdrew under fire was out of Lebanon. And now doing it again, and at the same time, could they really want to deal with an Islamic State controlling Damascus and the Scud missiles? I mean, those people at the end of the day are crazy. And they would have no problem firing Scud missiles into Israel and whatever arsenal is left behind by Bashar al-Assad, including chemical weapons. I think he destroyed all of in the sarin. I mean, the Israelis are like us. They have no easy options. Supporting Saudi Arabia, switching this balance in the Middle East somehow, there's only so much they can do. Whether they're dealing with reality or not, I can't tell you. I mean, I would rather deal with Tehran than I would with Raqqa, the Islamic State. But that's me.
So you don't really buy this scenario then? It's not likely that...
Oh, they might do it irrationally, just like we might irrationally support the Shia militias going into Al-Anbar province, which is, either way, you're taking sides in a civil war, which neither the Israelis nor we fully comprehend, nor do we have any idea where this is going to end up, whether this is a prairie fire that's going to hit, for instance, the Gulf or the rest of the Middle East. We just don't know. And people in the Middle East don't know either, but they suspect the worst. They fear the worst.
But is it possible then that there is a plan B, and that is a second war in Syria against the Islamic State, assuming that they eventually prevail? Is there any way to, because the people in the neighborhood have to recognize the consequences. Certainly the Israelis do, and maybe even the Turks do, and quite possibly the Saudi Arabians do, that you've created this monster. And now that it's victorious and contained, you have to destroy it.
I think it'll destroy Saudi Arabia before Saudi Arabia will destroy it. The Turks are not Arabs. They have a better organized state. I think they could probably contain it on their borders. You don't see any violence really moving into Turkey other than Kurdish violence, and that's limited. I think they can probably handle it. I think at the end of the day, the Turks want to destroy Iranian influence too, just like the Saudis. And once that's done, they'll simply pull out. But this turning on Saudi Arabia is probably the most likely scenario. I mean, they've been riding this Wahhabi thing for 250 years or whatever it is since the 19th century, and this is going to come back and destroy the royal family. It just, I don't see how it can't, because everything the Islamic State does, its version of Islam was all invented in Saudi Arabia, and this is the ideas that these people depend upon to rule, the Wahhabis, the religious police, the beheadings, and the rest of it, as you mentioned. And, so the Islamic State, they're fellow travelers with Riyadh. And I think the Saudis, I can't prove this, at least on a private basis, are funding the Islamic State, if only to destroy an Iranian influence.
So, as you know, Robert Baer, I've interviewed Senator Bob Graham, who's the former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chair of the Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And he's fairly convinced that there is a Saudi role, there was a Saudi role, a prominent Saudi role in 9/11, and is trying to get these 28 pages declassified from the report that his committee generated. And I spoke to him last Sunday about this. And one of the questions that arises out of the conversations with Senator Graham and other congresspeople that I've spoken to who have actually read the pages, you can go into the basement of the Senate Intelligence Committee without any recording devices, without any notes, without any staff. And if you're cleared, you can read the 28 pages. You can't take them away. And at the end of the day, Rand Paul and Ron Wyden have introduced a bill into the Senate to get them declassified. It's unlikely that Obama will do that because of this peculiar relationship we have with Saudi Arabia. But nevertheless, Rand Paul, is, at the end of the day, might well read the contents, or at least some version of the contents, into the Senate record on the floor with immunity. He won't be able to read the pages, but I guess he maybe can memorize them. I don't know. But this is a long-winded way to say the question that arises from listeners who were quite upset by what Senator Graham had to say and alarmed by it. The one question I was kept getting is, why would the Saudis have done it? Why did they organize, if assuming it's true, organize and finance 9/11? What was their motive?
Well, we don't know that they did organize and fund it, but certainly the Saudis that met the two hijackers, LAX, and later funded them in San Diego, our criminal law should have been indicted for conspirators, co-conspirators. Now, who they answered to, we clearly don't know. And we clearly don't know what Saudi Arabia did to explain how the 15 hijackers managed to get here. I mean, four of them were from a particular tribe. I mean, what did that tribe say? I mean, how did those four kids, I mean, they didn't find their way here on their own. They didn't answer a classified ad. Clearly, Saudi Arabia has not answered any of the essential questions, so they're not on our side on this. Now, is it possible that a Wahhabi inside the regime supported these people and knew about 9/11 in advance? Yes, it's possible. Did the king of Saudi Arabia know? did the former King Abdullah know? I just don't know. But they're clearly not cooperative, and clearly this administration and the last do not want the facts out because they're damning. And that question is going to be asked, whether they knew about it. And the reason that they would have done this, the motivation, is they still, in spite of our diplomatic cooperation and the rest of it, and oil, and they still look at us as the enemy.
Infidels.
As infidels, as Wahhabi Islam. They look at us as occupying Dar Islam, as they call it, the House of Islam. And we are the major backers of Israel, and we, for instance, got rid of Saddam Hussein, was in a sense their ally, and you go on and on. I mean, the bill of indictment, the Wahhabi bill of indictment against us is long, and if they look at us, and especially in apocalyptic terms, as an enemy, not just because we're a Judaic Christian country or anything like that, but just the West, which is at war with Islam, it's completely justified in their eyes. So they would have had a motivation, not a rational one, but one based on belief.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the movie Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an historian about Washington's great game and why it's failing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and is the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance States, among other works. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, Washington's Great Game and Why It's Failing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And in your article, you say at the outset, geography is often destiny, and that the Asian landmass, in effect, at the end of the day, could end up being the empire of the world. But I guess where we should start out is where you start out, which is on a cold London evening in January of 1904, when Sir Halford Mackinder, the director of the London School of Economics, made a speech that laid out this thesis that the route to global power lies not in controlling sea lanes, but in controlling the vast landmass that he called Euro-Asia. So is that where we begin?
That's the best place to begin, because not only was that a specific article making a series of predictions, but it was also the start, the invention of the modern science or study of geopolitics, the relationship between geography and global history. And most of the major leaders and many of the analysts throughout the 20th century have been, if you will, the intellectual acolytes of Halford Mackinder. An amazingly diverse array of people, everybody from Adolf Hitler to Zbigniew Brzezinski. Basically, what Mackinder did as a geographer was he simply turned the globe away from the usual focus, at least in the United States, on North and South America. So he turned it so that he placed the, the Europe, Asia, and Africa at the center, and then he tilted the globe slightly northward, and then he redrew it, and he reconceptualized the world. And he saw not three separate continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa, but a great landmass that he dubbed the World Island. And he said that this is the center, and particularly what he called the pivot or the heartland, the vast steppes between the Volga River and the Yangtze, this enormous sprawling region full of resources and then and now rather lightly populated. And he said that this is the heartland is the pivot of history. He who controls the heartland controls the world island, and he who controls the world island controls the world. And that left, of course, some outlying, rather inconsequential secondary islands that we know by the names of Australia, North America, and South America. And that stunning geopolitical vision became, if you will, much of the basis for understanding the great wars and conflicts of the 20th century that followed Alfred Mackinder's seminal speech that night. Basically, what he said is that Britain and really all of Europe since about 1600 had attempted to control the world islands from its maritime margin, those encircling sea lanes. He said that once, however, Russia, in alliance with another power such as Germany, was able to knit the world island together, mine its resources, he thought, through railroads. He said that this would change the dynamic of the world, shift the pivot of history from the sea lanes inland to the heartland of the world island, and thus change the locus of geopolitical power. Another scholar, who's actually the leading scholar of British imperial decline, a man named John Darwin at Oxford University, wrote a book, very important book, called After Tamerlane, about the struggle for the Eurasian landmass from the 14th century onward. And he said that he attributed America's extraordinary rise to power in 1945, indeed America's global power for the past 70 years, for the Washington's ability to control what he called the axial points of the world island in Western Europe, England and Western Europe through NATO, and Japan at the other side, and then to link them together with, if you will, a strategy that looked rather similar to Great Britain in the 19th century through these maritime patrols. Indeed, if you think of much of U.S. policy, much military and geopolitical strategy throughout the long period of the Cold War, and for the entire past 70 years, we've really followed Mackinder's observations. Think about what we did during the Cold War. We created three great fleets. We created a fleet for the Atlantic and the Mediterranean in 1946. Then we created the 7th Fleet based at Subic Bay, Philippines, for the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean right after World War II. And then in the 1990s, we created the 5th Fleet, replacing the British at Bahrain at their old naval base to monitor the Persian Gulf. So that was the first part. The next thing we did is we created a string of multinational and bilateral alliances, starting with NATO in 1949, going next the Baghdad Pact for the Middle East Alliance, then the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, the ANZUS Agreement, Australia-New Zealand-U.S. Defense Pact, and then the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. So we rimmed the Eurasian landmass from the maritime margins with these treaties. And then since 2011, we've built the latest in this ever-growing rim of security around the Eurasian landmass. We've constructed 60 bases for drones. Some of them, like the Global Hawk drone, has a flying time of 35 hours, a range of nearly 9,000 miles. And these 60 bases stretch from Sicily through the Seychelles, Diego Garcia, Guam. There are bases in Afghanistan. They rim all the way around the Eurasian landmass. So this has been the key to U.S. security for the past 70 years. And China has now come up with, I think, is a strategy that realizes Mackinder's vision and can defeat the U.S. strategy for control of the world island.
Just to sort of finish up on Mackinder, in 1943, which is, of course, 2 years before the World War II ended, a very elderly Mackinder published his last article, The Round World and the Winning of the Peace, in the U.S. Journal Foreign Affairs, where he said that the dream of global air power would not change the geopolitical basis. If the Soviet Union emerges from this war as conqueror of Germany, he warned, she must rank as the greatest land power on the globe, controlling the greatest natural fortress on Earth. So that, you know, to some extent came to pass, although it was, as you pointed out, contained during the Cold War. But our policy of containing China. Now, does this thesis, though, rest on the idea of China and Russia forming some kind of partnership, union, or alliance?
Well, Mackinder imagined that somehow the industrial strength of Germany, you know, that's what he was thinking about back in 1904. So what he realized is that you needed another partner. The industrial strength of Germany married to the raw resources of the Russian heartland, that's a vast area of many thousands of miles from the Volga all the way to the Yangtze. What he couldn't imagine, of course, back in 1904, has been the extraordinarily rapid rise of China to the world's probably at this point preeminent industrial power, surpassing certainly Japan a few years ago, and probably, depending on how you do the calculation, probably, but already having surpassed the United States. And so what we're looking at is a realization of Mackinder's principles, the marriage of an industrial power to the raw natural resources in the heartland of the world island, and that producing this extraordinary power. And that's what we're witnessing. China, and it's become apparent just in the last couple of months, China's strategy. And China's strategy appears to be elegant in simplicity, a very deft two-part strategy. One, to build a massive network of rails and pipelines that link China to the whole of the Eurasian landmass and allow it to begin to shift the resources, particularly gas and oil, into China from Central Asia and Russia. And second, a strategy for slicing through the encircling heavy metal rim of power that the United States has maintained around the world island for the past 70 years. And the figures on China's construction of oil pipelines are absolutely stunning. I mean, just in the last 7 or 8 years, China has signed a series of agreements to build massive pipelines from Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan in Central Asia all the way into China. Just last year, Russia and China, Gazprom and the China National Oil Corporation signed a $400 billion 30-year agreement to ship Russian gas into China. Just a few years ago, China completed the construction of a massive pipeline that goes essentially from the Andaman Sea across Burma into southwestern China. And through this comprehensive network of pipelines, China is bringing the vast oil and natural gas resources of the heartland region of the world island and marrying them to its industrial complex. China has also spent hundreds of billions of dollars in building the world's largest high-speed rail system. By the time it's done in 2030, every major city in China will be linked in that system. They've also began creating, and they're about to construct, a high-speed rail link between Shanghai and Moscow that will allow 2 days between those points. They're constructing another high-speed rail link from Kunming to Singapore that will cut that to a 10-hour trip. More importantly, they're building... They've already established, in cooperation with German, Kazakh, and Russian rail, basically two integrated rail corridors that allow the shipment of high-value goods, such as computer parts and automotive parts, between, let's say, Duisburg, Germany, and Western China in 14 days, far less than the 35 days shipping time. In other words, through the construction of this massive rail link and this cat's cradle of pipelines, China is realizing Mackinder's vision of tying the power of the world's greatest industrial complex in China to the world's preeminent source of natural resources in the heartland. And then, as Mackinder says, the empire of the world comes into view. There's also a second part of China's strategy that I think, begins to make sense of some of the geopolitical tensions we've been seeing in the past few weeks over the South China Sea. China is, I think, definitely developing a strategy to simply slice through America's encircling ring of containment that stretches from the Mediterranean through the Indian Ocean all the way up to Japan. And they're slicing through strategically at two points, one in the Arabian Sea and the second in the South China Sea. Since 2007, China, in cooperation with Pakistan, spent $200 billion in building a new port on the shore of the Arabian Sea at Gwadar. And recently, the president of China announced a $43 billion project to link Western China to the port of Gwadar to a kind of superhighway, an integrated transportation corridor of rails, high-speed roads, and pipelines. So that Gwadar, on the Arabian Sea, just a day's sail from the strategically important Persian Gulf, becomes a future Chinese naval base. And then, as we all know, in the South China Sea, China has accelerated its dredging to construct three potential military air bases in the Spratly Islands. That's been the subject of a great deal of press commentary, and tensions between Washington and Beijing at the very highest levels. The other thing that China's done, which most commentators have ignored, is they've recently expanded their facility at Long Po Naval Base on Hainan Island, which is at the southern end of the South China Sea, and they can now handle nuclear submarines. So this is the first nuclear submarine base on the South China Sea being built by China, and they're stationing their growing nuclear submarine fleet there. And by this means, China's going to be able to kind of slice through this heavy metal encirclement that the United States has maintained rimming the world island for the past 70 years, rendering our massive armada of aircraft carriers and cruisers, fighters and drones, effectively irrelevant.
And, of course, by shipping Persian Gulf oil through the port of Gwadar in Pakistan directly into China across the land bridge, the $46 billion China-Pakistan economic corridor, this does sort of make a kind of mockery, if you will, of the obsession of naval planners at the Pentagon. What they talk about, SLOCs, sea lanes of communications, the Straits of Malacca, all that becomes irrelevant. Well, let's take a brief station break, Alpha McCoy, and we'll return in a moment and continue the conversation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we are continuing the conversation with Alfred McCoy, who holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and is the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. He has an article at Tom Dispatch, Washington's Great Game and Why It's Failing. So how much does this Russia China alliance, if you will, where it is Mackinder's vision, originally was Germany, German industrial base, and Russia's raw materials. In this case, it's this growing manufacturing base in China with Russia's raw materials. That's the economic heart of the thesis that you're putting out. How does the politics work? I mean, there's a certain symmetry between Putin and Xi Jinping. They're not brutal dictators, but they're sort of dictators, nevertheless, presiding over a state-controlled capitalist kleptocracy.
Yeah, I think it's going to be it's an illiberal world order. There's no doubt about it. But I think that it's a different state model. In other words, as hybrid economies, the combined capitalism with the residue of a command economy in Russia and still a thriving command economy in China, what you've got is a very different model of capitalism in these two states, shared to a certain extent, let's say, by Iran. The idea that the state controls the entrepreneurs, that the entrepreneurs are allowed to accumulate private wealth, but they do so at the consent of the state, at the direction of the state, and if they deviate from state policy, they're punished, and their vast financial empires can be destroyed. So it's a kind of a command economy capitalism, a bold hybrid model that's illiberal, that requires subordination of the state. That's very different from the model that we're getting now in Europe and the United States, where our billionaires and our banks have decided that they're going to shrink the state apparatus and to maximize private accumulation, public squalor, shrink the global commons, disinvest in education infrastructure, and all the rest. And so what you've got is, in effect, two different state models competing for global dominion. And I would venture, and this could be, and it's just a guess, I would venture that when you're talking about building empires with the state at the epicenter of the orchestration and array of all this power, that a system with a powerful state that's self-conscious and disciplined and focused versus a system that's emphasizing private accumulation, the minimization of the state, I would say that the stronger state apparatus has a possibility of winning over the longer term. So the politics, I think, are also corresponding in this case with the economic alignment to allow a shift in global power.
Well, I think you may well be right. And I guess in a way it's a struggle between whether freedom, if that's the right word, is a more powerful enemy of the state in the case of Russia and China than the rampant greed of this oligarchy that runs our alleged democracy. So choose your poison, I guess.
Well, I mean, again, if you look at the comparative infrastructure that China and Russia and now with Europe are collectively building across the vastness of the Eurasian landmass, and then turn and look at North America and ask yourself, is there anything comparable in terms of the efficiency of infrastructure? What's the shipping time via rail from Latin America to North America? The answer is, of course, doesn't exist. There is no infrastructure. But look at the collapsing 19th century American rail transport infrastructure in the North American continent. Our hyper-thin oil tankers exploding in Lake Majestic, going off the rails across the Midwest, Amtrak trains careening off the tracks, at low speeds. I mean, and look at what China has by comparison.
Well, you certainly won't get an argument out of me, because it is so criminal what's happening in this country, where you have interest rates at an all-time low, which would mean that it would be cheap to invest in infrastructure. It would put people back to work. But our government at the moment, is largely controlled by these anti-government zealots who are essentially whores and hirelings of the Koch brothers and the oligarchs.
What I call the bozo billionaires. They've accumulated much of the wealth of this country and the discretionary political power that goes with it, and they have decided their primary agenda is to minimize the state, cut the taxes, and allow the maximization of the return, and then they can build to their heart's content, if you will, the latter day equivalent of Egyptian pyramids. They can build these grand monuments to their vision, their glory, their grandeur, while the commons are beggared and decline. China is investing heavily in its education system, in the PISA tests, which test the abilities of 15-year-olds. China Shanghai students are scoring number one. Americans are down around mid-20s, low 30s in math and science, and falling faster all the time. And you can say, who cares if a bunch of pimply-faced 15-year-olds in Shanghai do better on the test than American kids? Well, in 20 years' time, those will be the computer scientists that will do the cyber warfare and the hacking into state computers for secrets and security and for patents. Those will be the scientists that are designing satellites, orbital satellites for spying and space warfare, designing the advanced fighter systems for any confrontation over the Arabian Sea or South China Sea or other points, other flashpoints. In other words, you know, we're disinvesting very, very rapidly, and technology changes in the space about every 5 years. So within a generation, China is going to have a very deep bench of highly educated, highly trained scientists, and we're going to be rather weaker than we are now. We're still, our average age of our scientists in many fields is middle-aged to elderly. China, it's all very young. And we're not investing in recreating this. In fact, we're breaking our education system.
Well, there in Wisconsin, of course, you've got this governor running for president who he's destroyed the union movement. Now he wants to destroy the education infrastructure and the teachers and the professors.
Well, that's a political question, but what you can say is that he's imposed the biggest cut on the University of Wisconsin system in the history of the system, a $250 million cut that was not required by any kind of fiscal emergency. He just did it because that is the dominant ideology of the billionaires and their acolytes in the Republican Party and in the archipelago think tanks in Washington, D.C. that they have created, that we are shrinking government. Again, as that brings me back to our earlier point, we're shrinking the state, and yet in this clash of empires, and it is a clash of empires, and in this struggle for global power, organizing that, directing it, and controlling at the heart of each of these two rival imperial systems in Washington and Beijing is a state apparatus.
Right.
And if you disinvest in your state and you shrink your state in a time of competition, a time of serious, sustained global competition, you will lose. And that's what we're doing. People in Washington, D.C., our bozo billionaires, nobody's paying attention. And when the history of the decline and fall of the American empire is written, I think future historians will ascribe much of the causality, the blame, if you will, to America's bozo billionaires, the national elites that were concerned with self-interest and didn't realize that ultimately their fate, too, would be decided by the fate of the American state.
Well, just in the last few minutes, then, I get back to political questions, although there's no disputing what you're saying. It's really, I think, a very important work that you're doing in the absence of the people, as you mentioned, that should be doing it. But thank God somebody's doing it, as far as I'm concerned. Now, in terms of the vulnerability of the players on both sides, it would seem to me that on the Chinese side, the leaders do look over their shoulder at a restive population. But on the American side, the plutocrats who run our money-driven politics and control most of our politicians, are they worried about the American people ever waking up? So who's going to wake up in terms of an opposition? The Chinese people who would perhaps rebel against this illiberal system, or the American people who seem to be supine in the face of this outrageous inequality?
It's an interesting question. First of all, what always happens for everybody in almost any social system, we're incredibly myopic. We're focused upon the minutiae of our lives. We don't understand the ecological, the environmental, social, and imperial system that in many ways shapes our destiny. Most Americans are, most people, I think, are unaware that they have been the invisible beneficiaries of empire until it's all over. The French were almost oblivious to their empire until it began to fall apart in the 1950s. Then suddenly it became an acute national issue. The British, more or less the same, acquired this vast empire, but everybody's obsessively focused on domestic political issues. The social welfare compact, social status and resources inside the United Kingdom. Americans are no different than the systems of any other imperial systems. It's the responsibility of national leaders to understand the complex global system, the incredible fragility of a nation's status within an international system, and to do its best as a national political elite to try and manage this system to balance the international and domestic forces. American elites produced a number of very clever people. Elihu Root, okay, who was Secretary of War and Secretary of State, who received the Nobel Peace Prize. He was not only the architect of America's territorial empire at century's turn after 1900, but Elihu Root is an unappreciated architect of the modern international system, the community of nations, all right? And then we've had some very skillful players of geopolitics who have come along from time to time. One of the men I think is underappreciated is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter. He understood the world island. He was a student of Halford Mackinder, one of the only ones in the entire American political elite. And you can fault him, but he played the geopolitical strategy brilliantly. He drove a knife of radical Islam into the Soviet heartland. He drew the Red Army into Afghanistan, where he destroyed them, and in the process, he sheared away Eastern Europe. You might say, what's the relationship between Eastern Europe and Afghanistan? Aren't they thousands of miles apart? Yes, they are, but geopolitically, they're integral, one to the other. Brzezinski is one of the very few master geopoliticians that understood this. And in the 1990s, he began talking and writing about what he'd done, and he recommended that we pay attention to this geopolitics in his writings. He wrote some very articulate work that, in many ways, seemed a paraphrase of Mackinder's early writings. So there have been some brilliant American leaders that have crafted and maintained this very fragile system of U.S. global power, called a U.S. empire, if you will. But unfortunately today, not so much. I think President Obama, to give him credit, when he talked about the pivot to Asia, he wanted to get out of the Middle East, he was being geopolitically savvy. Because when you think about it, I mean, what's the Middle East in geopolitical terms, in terms of the world island? Let's think about it. It's a region that's overpopulated. They've got half of their population, known as women, who are basically non-productive, frozen out of the formal sector. They haven't invested in knowledge industries. They haven't invested in the education and welfare of their population. So they're running out of water. Their oil is being pumped out. Oil resources are shifting elsewhere. This is a dying, overpopulated region where, tragically, the four horsemen are now beginning to ride. And as that region sinks into slaughter and misery and shedding of human population, it will become increasingly geopolitically irrelevant to these larger trends elsewhere in the world island. And what is the United States focused on in the world? This marginal region, a complete disinvestment right from the beginning. Well, so Obama was very clever to try and shift us.
Well, Alfred McCoy, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I very much appreciate you joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alfred McCoy, who holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and is the author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. He has an article at Tom Dispatch, Washington's Great Game and Why It's Failing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.